From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. A prominent Russian lawmaker and the chief of the Foreign Affairs Committee in the Russian Parliament today pointed to inconsistencies between NATO's condemnation of a crackdown on Ukrainian protesters in Kiev and its silence in the face of similar police violence in the U.S. Duma member Alexei Pushkov tweeted overnight, quote, NATO has condemned the use of excessive force against Kiev demonstrators, but it was probably okay to beat anti-NATO protesters in Chicago, closed quote, referring to incidents in May of last year when scores of American anti-war activists were arrested at protests outside the NATO summit. Many were reportedly beaten and injured by Chicago police. Pushkov's statement came after Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said he was amazed by the fact that the military alliance believed itself to be in a position to issue statements on Ukraine's domestic affairs. Speaking at a press conference following a Russia-NATO Council session in Brussels yesterday, Lavrov said, quote, I don't know why NATO Secretary General Rasmussen should answer the question as to whether Russia could send troops to Ukraine. In my view, this produces a distorted picture, and such signals may cause an absolutely incorrect understanding of what is going on in some distorted and inflamed minds, closed quote. Meanwhile, in Kiev, the German foreign minister and the speaker of the Lithuanian parliament have taken part in rallies which openly seek to force a change in Ukraine's government. A few short years ago, this would have been seen as not merely a breach of diplomatic etiquette, but as direct interference in a sovereign country's internal affairs, in fact, a crime under international law. Mark Sloboda, a senior lecturer and researcher at the International Relations Department of Moscow State University, spoke earlier today with Voice of Russia Radio about the external pressures and internal contradictions which are behind the current unrest in Ukraine.
What we're looking at in the Ukraine is a tussle, both economic and there is a civilizational choice aspect, which particularly the European Union is pushing, to force the Ukraine to make a kind of bipolar Cold War choice. As for Russia, I don't think there's any doubt that the Russia is exerting pressure on the Ukraine to keep within its sphere of political and economic interest. There is a Commonwealth of Independent State Free Trade Area existing, which would adequately be abrogated if the Ukraine joined with this assigned this European Union free trade area. So like any state, particularly states of great power status, Russia has deployed a series of carrots and sticks, economic and political, to try to pressure the Ukraine. And also, within the Russian foreign policy elite's minds, to show them where their best interests lie, because there is no doubt a strong historical, cultural connection between Russia and my wife herself is from the Ukraine, born in the Crimea in Simferopol. And most of the people in the east and the south of the country who are Russian ethnic and Russian speaking feel extremely strong connections to Russia. And in the latest poll, actually, by the Ukrainian International Institute of Sociology, taken on kind of the inappropriate question of would you rather have the Ukraine join the customs union, which is on offer, and join the European Union, which is not on offer. That this association agreement says nothing about becoming a full member of the European Union. That's not even discussed in the 1,500-page document at all. But 38% split, half and half in the country, mostly along absolute geographic lines. And this is a big problem, because by exacerbating the issue, you are fanning sectarian flames in the Ukraine. But Russia is not entirely without fault either. And I think you can point to the sanctions placed on the Roshen chocolate company over sanitation as a clumsy, heavy-handed, and inappropriate shot across the bow. That certainly isn't to the level of European Union politicians encouraging revolution in central Kiev. But you can see that both states are attempting to deploy carrots and sticks.
Meanwhile, more leaked documents from whistleblower Edward Snowden revealed that the NSA had Swedish intelligence spy on Russian leaders. According to the leaked documents, Sweden's cable access made its position unique in the eyes of the NSA. We have this report from RT.
Now, Sweden's been helping America's NSA to spy on Russian leaders and provided Washington with a list of high-profile targets. Swedish state TV cite documents leaked by whistleblower Edward Snowden. Well, let's go live now to RT's Peter Oliver, who has got more details for us. Peter, what exactly is emerging here?
Well, these latest leaked documents look into the Swedish National Defence Radio Establishment. Now, that's known as the FRA. That monitors communications in the Swedish intelligence service. Now, it claims that that the FRA were looking into high-priority Russian targets. This includes leadership and internal political figures. Now, it's unclear from the documents that have been put forward whether senior leaders like Vladimir Putin or anybody else had their private communications listened into. And we've tried to contact both the FRA and President Putin's spokesperson, both of them saying they don't comment on these type of matters. Now, a separate document that was released was addressed to NSA personnel that were working with the Swedes, and it told them that they should thank Sweden for the continued work on the Russian target. Now, all of this coming out showing that Sweden is just another part of the system of this widespread global NSA spying program that seems to be looking into many other countries and has many other countries working as partners with it. And this information, of course, comes out on the same day as it's been revealed that the NSA tracks the mobile phone records of 5 billion people per day. Those mobile phone records, of course, would allow you to know where somebody was moving around the world. So it seems that months after we first heard from the leaks of Edward Snowden, revelations continue to come out, this time showing that Sweden was helping the NSA to spy on Russia.
Yeah, it is a fascinating development. Thank you very much. That's RT's Peter Oliver. Well, we can bring in British investigative journalist Paul Lashmar now to talk more about this story. There he is. Mr. Lashmar, thank you very much for coming on to the programme. Now, I mean, all this is yet to be verified, but if it does prove to be true, how much of a controversy could this blow into?
Well, it won't help the relationship between Sweden and Russia. I think what's going on here is we've known for a long while that the Swedish SIGINT capability is quite developed. It's worked a lot with the British intelligence in the past. But as with all things to do with Edward Snowden's documents, there's one thing for experts on the outside thinking, suspecting that we are under all sorts of surveillance. It's quite another when we actually start to get the evidence, and then we realise the sheer scale, which I think exceeds the expectations of virtually anybody, the sheer scale of international mass surveillance on individuals, governments, and anybody that they take an interest in.
And wouldn't it also surprise many people, do you think, that Sweden is actually involved in this? Because they have not been involved in any revelations so far. So presumably many would be surprised, yourself maybe included, that they are involved in this snooping.
Well, it's been known on those who take an interest that Sweden has a good capability, and it has been locked in. It has worked with GCHQ, certainly in the past. But I think this really sort of ups the game, the fact that we're talking about unique, the document describes them as providing new, unique insight into what's going on in Russia.
And what about the timing of these leaks? Is that significant in any way?
Well, that's hard to tell. I mean, it seems to me that the way that the Snowden material is coming out is incremental. But whether it's timed, it's very hard to tell, because it's hard to know when the journalists who were, the Swedish TV journalists who did this, when they got the documents, and how long it's taken them to verify the information that they've got. So it's very hard to judge whether something is premeditated for a particular effect.
And in terms of ramifications, again, we can only speculate. But what do you think about the relationship between Russia and Sweden now? Because they have been cooperating on many projects, including those in the Arctic region. Could they be in jeopardy, do you think?
Well, it's always this, but everybody knows everybody spies on everybody else. We don't know the extent. And I think that what we've discovered in the last few months is just the sheer scale of it. So, you know, and it's quite a different, it sort of puts things in a different position when you know for certain that another country is looking into your country. And I think, you know, that so it may have an impact. I don't suspect the Russian government's going to be best pleased to see this material. And it may feed into, you know, it may cause a bad diplomatic fallout ultimately.
And in terms of, you mentioned there about the wide scale of this snooping, I mean, how far can it stretch? I mean, they can literally follow people's mobile phones and pick up conversations on all cell phones. I mean, where can it end?
Well, what we now know is that the US, aided by a number of countries, including Britain, Sweden, Canada, are engaged in mass surveillance on a scale that we hitherto that we really wouldn't have thought was possible, except in science fiction accounts. I mean, the sheer scale of it is absolutely phenomenal.
And how much of that do you think is intentional? The NSA, for example, says that it's not tracking people's movement intentionally, but it does happen to get location data from all their mobile phones. And they say that that is also legal. I mean, what's your view on that?
Well, is it legal? I mean, this is all up in the air. If it was accidental, why were they doing it? They don't collect this stuff for nothing. What are they looking for exactly? What are the implications? What do they do with it? How long do they store it? All these questions are up in the air. Is it legal? Well, one gets very mixed messages from the United States about the legality of this. The agencies say they're doing things legally, but then you see senior congressmen saying, whoa, I didn't know they were doing that, and I'm on one of the committees. But, you know, my 30 years of experience tells me that the whole thing with intelligence agencies, if you give them a mission and you allow them to conduct their business in secret, the mission creeps. They always expand. It's in their innate nature. That's why they have to be incredibly tightly regulated and have, you know, major oversight. And I think we're beginning to see that oversight hasn't worked in all these countries.
Africa and the world's crosshairs. We have four reports today highlighting the special attention being paid to developments in Africa, at the UN, and beyond. First, the UN Security Council today authorized French and African troops in Central African Republic to use force to protect civilians. The resolution also imposed an arms embargo on the country and asked the United Nations to prepare for a possible peacekeeping mission. In a unanimously adopted resolution, the 15-member council also asked UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon to establish an inquiry into human rights abuses in the landlocked, mineral-rich nation of 4.8 million people, which has slipped into chaos following the ouster by rebels of President Francois Bozizé in March. The number of Ethiopian migrants returning from Saudi Arabia has surpassed the 100,000 mark, according to the International Organization for Migration, or the IOM. Saudi Arabia has deported over 100,000 Ethiopians following a violent crackdown against immigrants in the kingdom, according to Ethiopia's Foreign Minister, Tedros Adhanom. All Ethiopians who had been detained in Riyadh deportation camps have been returned, and up to 50,000 more citizens are still expected to come home, according to the foreign minister. Ethiopia started repatriating its citizens last month after a seven-month amnesty period for undocumented immigrants expired, sparking protests. Foreign Ministry spokesperson Dina Murty told AFP, quote, "The number is increasing over time," closed quote. The UN is monitoring developments. Patrick Megwa reports from Geneva.
IOM says the return operation is overwhelming its available resources and is appealing for $13 million to be able to provide reintegration support to the migrants, the majority of whom have returned empty-handed. The number of chartered planes bringing the migrants back to Ethiopia has risen from 6 flights per day up to 20 flights. The majority of those who have arrived back are men, but there is also a significant number of unaccompanied minors. Upon arrival, the migrants are registered, provided with food, undergo a medical checkup, and are given a $50 stipend to enable them to travel back to their homes. Sharon Dimonch from IOM in Addis Ababa says most of the migrants were not only victims of human trafficking, but also had their human rights violated while in Saudi Arabia.
As of yesterday, 100,620 migrants have returned. IOM has been able to provide post-arrival assistance to over 90,000 of these migrants. The number is increasing as we are currently registering approximately 7,000 migrants daily. The stories they are telling us are mainly of rape and torture. Men have watched their wives being defiled before their eyes. Women feel dirty and tainted after the inhuman acts. The first groups to arrive also had sad narrations of being beaten by mobs of young men in the streets of Saudi. Some of them had not had their wages paid by the time they were leaving for Ethiopia. They were being robbed of their money, shoes. Many of them came with torn clothes, dirty, barefoot. They would definitely want to look for better opportunities elsewhere. If we, not only we as IOM, but all the other implementing partners, do not work at a long-term intervention to be able to address the main root causes why these people left Ethiopia in the first place.
The return of the migrants follows the passing of a new legislation in Saudi Arabia requiring all migrants to regularize their stay and obtain work permits. Thousands of undocumented migrants, mainly from Yemen and Ethiopia, have been detained and are being repatriated to their countries of origin.
Improving the quality, availability, and relevance of data on food and agriculture around the African continent has become a key priority as Africa strives to tackle persistent food security problems. Don Bob reports.
The issue took center stage as an unprecedented number of experts from 35 countries met for the 23rd session of the African Commission on Agricultural Statistics, an FAO statutory body. About 100 senior statistics officials were set to discuss country experiences with the World Programme for the Census of Agriculture and the rollout of the Global Strategy to Improve Rural and Agricultural Statistics. They also planned to look at advances in gathering environmental, economic and food security statistics on issues like greenhouse gas emissions, agricultural investments, livestock and sex disaggregated or gender-related data for land ownership. Reliable statistics are vital in tracking both country needs and achievements. For instance, accurate government expenditure data are needed to track country commitments to spend at least 10% of total expenditures on agriculture, in keeping with the Maputo Declaration of 2003. Statistics on government spending show that so far, only Burkina Faso, Ethiopia, Ghana, Guinea, Malawi, Mali, Niger, and Senegal have met or exceeded the Maputo target. Deputy Director of the FAO Statistics Division, Yosef Schmidyuba, said we need timely, accurate and reliable statistics to give us a better picture of how agriculture and food security are affected by and how they impact economic, environmental and social factors. Ultimately, this kind of information can be used by decision makers to develop policies, programs and investments that improve people's lives. Don Bob, United Nations.
And the UN, like the world at large, has its eyes firmly focused on the continent's vast natural wealth. According to Agency Chief Achim Steiner at the UN Environmental Program, or UNEP, sustainable and optimal management of Africa's natural resources will be crucial to achieving long-term development and poverty alleviation. Steiner says that as Africa still has many resources, which are increasingly in short supply in other parts of the world, the continent stands to be a key player in framing what he called, quote, more intelligent management, close quote, of the natural world. We have this report from Diane Penn.
UNEP is based in Nairobi, Kenya, where African ministers, economists, scientists, and development experts wrapped up a meeting on Wednesday aimed at incorporating the valuation of natural resources in development planning and accounting. A report released last year by UNEP and the Kenya Forest Service found that deforestation had deprived that country's economy of nearly $70 million in 2010. However, recent economic valuations of Kenya's forests have resulted in efforts to conserve and rehabilitate this vast natural resource.
Thailand's king, Boumibol Adulyadej, called on his people to do their duty for the security of the country in a birthday address today. However, he avoided making direct reference to the latest political turmoil there, according to Reuters. Five people have been killed in clashes over the past week as protesters have attempted to bring down the government of Prime Minister Yingluck Shinawatra. The two sides reached a truce to mark the king's birthday. The 86-year-old king, who has defused previous crises, referred to his people doing their duty to support each other for the sake of the country. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry today assured Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu that core sanctions against Iran will remain in place despite an interim nuclear deal. At a press conference in Jerusalem, Kerry said, quote, "The fundamental sanctions regime of oil and banking remains absolutely in place. We will be stepping up our effort of enforcement through the Treasury Department and through the appropriate agencies of the United States," close quote. Netanyahu earlier said that steps must be taken to prevent a further erosion of sanctions. We have this report from Press TV.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says Israel's security is high on America's agenda in nuclear talks with Iran.
I can't emphasize enough that Israel's security in this negotiation is at the top of our agenda. And the United States will do everything in our power to make certain that Iran's nuclear program, a program of weaponization possibilities, is terminated.
Kerry made the remarks at a news conference with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in Jerusalem. He said the U.S. will consult closely with Israeli officials in order to bring about a comprehensive agreement regarding Iran's nuclear program. The top U.S. diplomat also stressed that the fundamental sanctions against Iran will remain in place during the negotiations. Iran and the permanent members of the U.N. Security Council plus Germany reached a deal over Tehran's nuclear energy program in Geneva last month. The interim agreement provoked strong reactions from Israel, with Netanyahu calling the accord a historic mistake.
Meanwhile, an Israeli cabinet minister visited Turkey today in the first such trip since the deadly raid by Israeli troops on a Gaza-bound human aid mission in May of 2010. Environment Minister Amir Peretz was due to attend a UN conference in Istanbul about pollution in the Mediterranean Sea. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu apologized last March over the raid, in which Israeli commandos killed 9 Turks, including an American citizen. An alliance of corporations and conservative activists and politicians is mobilizing to penalize homeowners who install their own solar panels, casting them as free riders on the energy grid, in a sweeping new offensive against renewable energy, according to an article in today's Guardian newspaper. According to the report, over the coming year, the American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC, will promote legislation with goals which include penalizing individual homeowners and weakening state clean energy regulations. Details of ALEC's strategy to block clean energy development at every stage, from the individual rooftop to the White House, were revealed as the group gathers for its policy summit in Washington this week. Some 800 state legislators and business leaders are due to attend the 3-day event. John Eich, the legislative analyst for ALEC's Energy, Environment, and Agricultural Program, said ALEC wants to lower the rate electricity companies pay homeowners for direct power generation and maybe even charge homeowners for feeding power into the grid. Gabe Elsner, director of the Energy and Policy Institute, said the attack on small-scale solar was part of the larger ALEC project to block clean energy. He said, quote, "They are trying to eliminate pro-solar policies in the states to protect utility industry profits," close quote. The group sponsored at least 77 energy bills in 34 states last year. The measures were aimed at opposing renewable energy standards, pushing through the Keystone XL pipeline project, and barring oversight on fracking, according to an analysis by the Center for Media and Democracy. More than half of U.S. workers are apparently unable to save enough money to cover essential living expenses for retirement. This according to a survey by Fidelity Investments. The survey found that 55% of the population will have trouble covering housing, healthcare, and food expenses. The online survey of 2,200 households performed from June through October measured whether workers were on track to cover their estimated post-retirement expenses. Out of respondents, 33% were on track to cover 95% or more of their estimated expenses, including discretionary expenditures such as travel and entertainment. 12% would be able to cover living but not discretionary expenses. 14% would not be able to cover living expenses and would have to make modest adjustments to their retirement plans. And 41% were so underfunded for retirement that they'd have to make significant lifestyle changes if they should quit working. The survey found that baby boomers, or those born between 1946 and 1964, were best prepared for retirement, but were still going to miss the mark, on pace to save only 80% of what they'll need in retirement. Those from Generation Y, or born between 1978 and 1988, were the least prepared. On average, they are on track to have only 60% of the money they'll need to cover retirement expenses. It's been 511 years since the first slaves were dragged from Africa to the Western Hemisphere. In the intervening centuries, people both white and black were taught that blackness was a badge of inferiority. That attitude persists in many parts of the hemisphere. Black Agenda Radio's Glenn Ford talks about a particular problem in the Dominican Republic.
If there is a country where self-hatred is the national creed, it is the Dominican Republic, an overwhelmingly mulatto nation that seems constantly at war with its own blackness. It is a country where Europeans have always been a small minority, yet whose national legislature once passed a law declaring that all Dominicans are white. Dominican beauticians have done their best to enforce that law by becoming the most skillful skin lighteners and hair straighteners in the world. It is obvious to any sane person that the Dominican Republic does not like itself and has no national identity except in opposition to the deeper blackness of Haiti, with whom it shares the island of Hispaniola and to which Dominicans owe a great debt for ridding their common territory of slavery more than two centuries ago. But the Dominicans are not grateful. Rather, they are perpetually resentful that the deep black presence of Haiti is always there to remind them of their own indelible African origins. Unable to purge themselves of their blackness, Dominicans periodically attempt to dispel the Haitians. In 1937, the Dominican Army killed as many as 20,000 dark-skinned people on the border with Haiti in what was called the Parsley Massacre. The most recent eruption of Haiti hatred was set off this September when a Dominican court ruled that up to 250,000 people of Haitian descent could be declared stateless persons. These include the children of Haitians who arrived generations ago, who speak only Spanish, dance to Latin rhythms, and have never been on the Haitian side of the border. Anyone born after 1929 who cannot point to one parent who was a Dominican citizen faces deportation. All the peoples of the Caribbean are familiar with the Dominican disease, that peculiar mass mental illness of self-hatred. Self-haters also make bad neighbors, and before long, grassroots activists across the Caribbean were urging their governments to take action against the Dominican outrage against Haitians and all black people. Although today's crop of Caribbean politicians is notable for its meekness, the Dominicans had gone too far. The Organization of Eastern Caribbean States expressed its grave abhorrence of the Dominicans' repulsive and discriminatory actions. Ralph Gonsalves, Prime Minister of St. Vincent and the Grenadines, called for the Dominican Republic to be suspended from the Caribbean community and cut off from access to subsidized Venezuelan oil. The Dominican Republic needs to learn that its twisted racial attitudes will no longer be tolerated. It may take generations to cure the sickness that afflicts so many Dominican minds, but the mostly African-descended Caribbean neighborhood has run out of patience with Santo Domingo. Dominican President Danilo Medina will soon submit to his legislature a national regularization plan for foreigners. Medina pretends that his countrymen want only to create an orderly system of immigration, but everyone knows it's all about Haitians and blackness. The fact is, Haitians make up more than 90% of the Dominican agricultural workforce. They are indispensable to the economy. The two peoples are linked by history and blood, a lesson that Dominicans will have to be taught by their Caribbean neighbors.
And in late-breaking news, New York City Mayor-elect Bill de Blasio has named William Bratton to return as the city's police commissioner, selecting the former NYPD police chief to head a department that has been criticized for its use of racially charged stop-and-frisk tactics. Bratton's tenure was very controversial during his time after being appointed by Mayor Rudolph Giuliani. We'll have more on that tomorrow. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.